On the evening of April 4th, 2019, at the Belgrade Public Library, Trout Unlimited's Laura Zimmer spoke about water rights, water fights, water supremacy in the West. She was introduced by Sarah Creech.
My name is Sarah Creech. I'm the Adult Services Librarian here at the library. Laura Zimmer is Senior Counsel and Water Policy Advisor at Trout Unlimited. She is widely known in the West for her work on collaborative water-saving projects with agricultural producers, watershed groups, and federal and state agencies for almost 2 decades. Laura started Trout Unlimited's water program by establishing Montana Water Project Office in 1998 and has helped grow Trout Unlimited's water work to 9 western states to restore and maintain stream flows for healthy rivers.
Thank you so much. It is such a pleasure to be here, and Sarah did a great job in organizing, and the Wonderlust program folks are just a delight to work with. So it's really a pleasure to be here tonight and see such a packed house. This is Remington's painting depicting water security a century ago. And what I'd like to talk to you about tonight is how we avoid having this be the depiction of water security in the next 50 years. This talk is really going to be in 3 chapters. So the first chapter is really going to be a snapshot of global water security. Like, where do we in the American West fit in a global issues of water, and how does water security look from a global perspective? Then the next chapter will be taking some lessons learned from one of our neighbors, the state of California, also the 7th largest economy in the world, and what we can learn about their unprecedented experience with drought. In that chapter as well, I'll talk about some of the structural challenges to addressing water scarcity in the American West. And then the final chapter will be an effort after all of that depressing information to turn to a more hopeful chapter to end. And then we'll talk about how here in Montana, we are growing solutions and creating solutions to water scarcity that not only work for the state of Montana, but are setting both a national and international precedent for secure water management and forward-looking solutions. So without further ado, let me launch into some of the depressing statistics about how much we are depleting our freshwater resources. That over a third of the planet's watersheds and aquifers are experiencing water shortages. That affects over half of the world's population. And even more stunningly, especially in an agricultural state like Montana, that's over 3/4 of the world's irrigated acreage. The darker the color in the slide, the more water scarcity. And I'll come back to this in a moment, but you'll see the areas of the globe that also have some of the most intense political and population strife also have some of the greatest water shortages. And that leads to some of the global challenges. Now I'd like to switch to talking about the underground aquifers. There are 37 large aquifers globally. 21, over half, are overdrawn, meaning we are pumping water out more quickly than either precipitation or other stream flow can replenish that aquifer. So that's over half of the aquifers are overdrawn. And 13 of those 21 are precipitously in decline. And that includes some of ours in North America, the Ogallala, and the Central Valley. So if we switch to some global discussions about what to do about water security, much of that attention has happened at the annual World Economic Forum in Switzerland, Davos. And this year in 2019 was no exception from a trend that started well before 2015, which is for that scan of what security means across the globe, from weapons of mass destruction, cyber attacks, terrorism, water and environmental risk, extreme weather events, are deemed to be greater risks to the global population than those other threats, either weapons of mass destruction, cyber attacks, or otherwise. They do this risk matrix every year. And in this particular one from 2015, this is water crises up here. And this is the likelihood of occurrence versus the magnitude of the risk. And there we have water crises at the top of the heap. in that context, I want to turn very briefly to one of the questions that people often ask when you're thinking about water globally, which is, isn't the planet 70% water? Like, what's the problem? Why do we have a water security issue when we have over half the planet is water? Well, and the answer to that is that trying to take the salt out of the ocean water is very expensive, takes a tremendous amount of energy, and we haven't figured out what to do with the salt yet. So you have three problems facing the desalinization issue. And this is just a simple cost graph from San Diego County asking the question, how much energy does it take for different sources of water? And to me, what's significant about this is that desalinization across the top takes more energy than taking water and pumping it all the way from Northern California down to Southern California. And that's uphill, by the way. When people say that desalinization takes a tremendous amount of energy and costs a lot, oh, and then you're creating another environmental problem with the brine, it means that it can be a localized solution, but it's not a solution for water shortage at scale. So where do we get our water? Well, we get our water from functioning ecosystems and from watersheds that are functioning well to supply that fresh water. And that is where we get our cheapest, cleanest, most available sources of fresh water. And so who pays for that? Well, there are a couple answers to that. You can pay to keep high-functioning watersheds protected and high-functioning, and we can also pay to restore degraded watersheds so that they serve better to supply those freshwater needs. And one of the best known examples of paying to keep, or the cost effectiveness of paying to keep a well-protected watershed functioning, is when New York City looked at whether to pass what seems like a lot of money, $660 million, what we call an EIB, an environmental impact bond, to put in safeguards to their Catskills Mountains watershed and that freshwater supply for New York City. That seems like a lot of money, $660 million, but compared to the alternative, which was $6 billion, a whole order of magnitude bigger for a plant, and then half the initial cost, $330 million, every single year to keep it running, suddenly protecting the watershed seemed really cheap. And when faced with between those two choices, New Yorkers overwhelmingly said, we'll pay the $660 million to keep the watershed intact. And that's one of New York City's success stories in terms of protecting their natural infrastructure for fresh water provisioning. What is New York City doing? What did that $660 million pay for? One, it took what were some inholdings, so that was not all state and federal lands in that watershed, and there were some inholdings, privately held lands. Part of the money went to pay to buy out those inholdings so that you wouldn't have private use within the watershed, roads, development, other things. Other pieces went to restore some of the degraded portions of the watershed. And then a third portion of that payment went to have more intensive monitoring so that we could find out if there were issues with the watershed and to put some protections in place in terms of restoration and both restoration monitoring and regulatory protections on the watershed. So now our next chapter. Lessons learned from California and from some of what I call the structural challenges of addressing water scarcity in the American West. This is just a graph of what California's water supply has looked at since the year 2000. So it's almost 20 years. And then the top line is the area of California affected. So when we have color going all the way to the top of the graph, that means that's the entire state of California. And the darker the color, the more intense the drought. That's what those stages of drought, drought 0 to drought 4, mean, is just a drought intensity. And so if you look in particular for this period that started at the end of 2014 and didn't end until 2017, that was a three-year period where the entire state of California was in drought, and much of the state, almost 50% of the state, was in extreme drought. That had never happened before in recorded history in California. So in 120 years, that had never been seen, and tree ring data going back many more centuries had not shown that intensity. And one of the things that made this particular drought so challenging was not just the fact that the entire state was under drought, and not just that the drought wasn't so intense, but in addition to the dryness, it was incredibly hot. And so what they're calling hot droughts made those dry conditions even more severe. So what happened? Well, it cost agriculture in California billions of dollars. It caused additional groundwater pumping, right? So that there was even more turning to groundwater pumping to make up those shortfalls. And hundreds of thousands of acres of cropland were idled. So there was a huge impact for the agricultural sector. I've been talking a little bit about groundwater, and I'll talk more about that when we get to our Why Montana is Different chapter of the talk tonight. But so what? What's the wrong with California in those drought years getting a full 60% of its water from groundwater pumping? Well, we talked earlier in the global snapshot about overdrafting, of pumping groundwater faster than the water can get replenished. When that happens, one of the impacts of that is not only that, right, then it's not sustainable because the water table is slowly dropping as you pump the groundwater, and it's dropping faster than it gets replenished by incoming rain or other river and stream flows, but there's also subsidence. You can think of it as your sponge. When you take the water out of it, at some point the sponge loses its spongy character, and subsidence means that the actual soil profile without the water in it starts to smoosh down and be like that peanut butter and jelly sandwich at the bottom of your lunch pack, you know, after it's like you sat on it once or went hiking and it's underneath your water bottle instead of on top of your water bottle, right? So you get that smashed peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And what that means is that then you can't put the water back in even if you have a good water year, or you pump it back in, right? The structure of the aquifer actually collapses. And the indication of that is by how fast the surface of the ground starts dropping. And in the Central Valley of California, where some of the most intense groundwater pumping was happening to maintain that agricultural productivity, even with the billions in the B dollars worth of ag production lost, you had subsidence happening between 2 and 25 inches per month, breaking infrastructure, cracking concrete, making roads unpassable, concrete lined ditches for water cracked and you could no longer carry water. That is one of the most extreme examples of what happens when you have the groundwater overdrafting. Peter Glick, who's long been a commenter and analyzer of Western water issues and Western issues in general, called it subsidence is really Mother Nature telling us we can't continue to do what we are doing. It is a physical manifestation of the irrationality of our groundwater system. Now, he was talking about California, not Montana, and that relates to why what we've done here in Montana is precedent setting. What happens in a normal year in terms of California's reliance on groundwater? Without the extreme drought, California is still 40% reliant on groundwater. They upped it to 60% in drought. But the trouble with California's 40% reliance is that was also an unsustainable rate. So what the drought did was take an already unsustainable rate of groundwater pumping and accelerate it. You're actually seeing almost landscape scale shifts. That's the volume of water that had been pumped. Folks were able to measure actually the Sierra Nevada actually rising in response as all the weight of that water was removed. That's what we call landscape scale effects. This is just one of California's largest reservoirs at the height of that drought period. And I show this to show two things. One, right, we can't see the aquifers being depleted in the same kind of dramatic way when you see an empty reservoir, especially a really big one like this Lake Shasta. But also, the other more invisible impact is that of the ecosystems that are really our reservoirs, our providers of cost-effective fresh water. And just like this reservoir was almost empty during that drought, the ecosystem impacts were severe. The dewatered rivers, the riparian areas, the impacts to fish and wildlife, and also to the ability of rivers, lakes, and streams to simply continue to function. And as those rivers and streams went dry, so did the ability to actually carry water from one water user to the other. And so the whole system began breaking down. And that's another reason for that extreme reliance on groundwater pumping, because the natural conveyance systems were likewise going into severe stress and overdrive. So what did California do about it? Well, what California usually does about things, it throws lots and lots of money at the problem. And it passed Proposition 1, and the governor essentially campaigned on this proposition for over a year to convince Californians that this had to be done. And it was the biggest water initiative in the history of the United States, $7.5 billion. What was interesting about California's approach, though, is that it reflected this understanding that water provisioning is a multifaceted undertaking. And the biggest pot of money, $2.7 billion, was for water infrastructure. But it had a number of other pots of money in there to try to address that whole portfolio of impacts, from the natural infrastructure and trying to restore and replenish the natural ecosystem and that ecosystem provisioning, to try to get after and get their arms around the issue of groundwater sustainability. They were trying to invest ahead of time for future droughts and invest in drought preparedness. They wanted to do water recycling because that's a lot cheaper than desalinization. And they invested in just trying to ensure that every Californian had access to safe and reliable drinking water, because during the drought, whole rural communities were completely without drinking water. We are still on the front end of that. That was passed, was finalized in 2015. The money didn't really start flowing until about 2016, so we're about 3 years into that Prop 1. And yes, California has done a tremendous job of getting a lot of money out to ecosystem restoration. They have built new infrastructure. They repaired a lot of that damaged infrastructure from subsidence. And they're beginning to get their arms around groundwater sustainability. But that groundwater piece is one of the big remaining challenges for California, because that's almost an unsolvable problem. What about California's end waters of users? So you have both the agricultural users, and then you have the users in the towns and coastal cities. And that's where California especially has made a huge investment, which is in their municipal use. Because once a coastal municipality turns their incoming freshwater to wastewater, it goes into the ocean, and it's no longer used for water supply. And so most now of the Californian communities are collecting that wastewater and treating it and reusing it, basically bringing it back up the supply chain and using it before it goes out to the ocean. So California's made some real progress. Whether they can withstand another drought cycle, like the kind they went through in those 2011 to 2050 years, remains to be seen. But they're, as a result of that Prop 1, of that $7.5 billion investment, they're in much better shape to do so than they were before. So I wanted to talk then a little more broadly about what the rest of the West shares with California. And one of that is that even though we have, in Montana, for example, we haven't experienced the same severity and duration of drought that California did, on a seasonal basis, as everyone knows, especially in August, we have low flows all over the West, and Montana there is no exception, right? Because the classic Wallace Stegner phrase, west of the 100th meridian, that geographic meridian falls along a natural precipitation demarcation, where west of the 100th meridian, we're just a lot drier than the rest of the country, which means that that's one of our structural challenges, right? That makes us different from the eastern part of the country, and that aridity and lack of water is just a fact of life for us out here in the West. How we deal with it, how we adapt to droughts, and how we manage our water, that's up for us to decide. And so I want to turn from the geographic and precipitation patterns as challenges to some of the what I call the structural challenges. And I call that legally dry. And What I mean by that is that our Western system of water laws is not doing us any favors when we're trying to think about water management in times of severe drought and about trying to balance water uses among multiple uses between our communities and cities, an industry, our agriculture, and our ecosystems. Our legal system is very poorly set up to address that very 21st century challenge. This is a picture I took of the Smith River, one of our blue ribbon trout fisheries in Montana, a river so popular it's the only river you have a permit system for. I keep putting in, I only have gotten it once before, but one of these days I'll draw another permit. And it went completely dry before the takeout, I might add, of the floating stretch in the year 2000. I'll back up and I'll illustrate what I mean by our system of water rights isn't doing us any favor by taking a quick detour over to the Madison River Valley and looking at Bear Creek, which is a tributary not far from the town of Ennis. And I'm going to run through a quick history of Western prior appropriation in 3 minutes. Right? Hold on, it's going to be fast. So this is a map of Bear Creek, starting in the mountains with all its tributaries and joining down here at the letter E with the Madison River. Here is a hydrograph, which just shows the average flow of the creek across its reach from the headwaters down to the mouth. So this is just showing us how much relative water there is. So here we are at the time that Lewis and Clark came through the Madison, about 1800s, and you have the full flow of the creek without any appropriated water rights. So then by 1867, the first settlers came to the valley and began putting that water to use by irrigating with it, taking a ditch, diverting the water down the ditch and taking it to the fields. Those settlers acquired senior water rights, the earliest water rights for those Bear Creek flows, right? First in time, first in right. Everyone knows that phrase. That's what that means. The first water rights on the land have the most senior position. And what's key about that first in time, first in right, is that they get their water before anybody else does in terms of priority. Like if there's a water shortage, their rights are fulfilled before others. So we go now to 1880, more settlers have arrived, and we have now less water in the stream, right? So this is the water left in the stream after that amount of appropriation up here at by 1881. Now we're getting to the turn of the last century. Now there's really almost no water left, but we're only at 1909. So you have to ask yourself, well, did the people stop coming then after 1909? The answer is no, the people still came and they still wanted water. So my question to you is, what's that? Over-appropriation, gold star, yes. That is what people call over-appropriation. More water rights than the source has water. I also call it human nature, that in a wet year, we don't remember the dry year. And that's what leads to the over-appropriation, because that 1 year, there was enough water to take. But then once you have the right, then there's an expectation that even in the dry year, you'll get water as a junior user. And there we have the nub of some of the great water fights in the West, is that very issue right there. And there's Bear Creek below the diversions. This is not just unique to Bear Creek. This is Indian Creek, also in the Madison Valley. If you're driving along the highway south of Ennis, you pass over Indian Creek. And if you drive it often, say, to like Reynolds Pass or going over to Island Park, if you're like me, every time I pass over there, I look and it's like, oh, is it flowing? Because there's a certain point after which in the spring, Indian Creek, which is full banked and flowing, goes completely dry from the diversions. And the fact that there is no water right for the creek itself to have water flowing is why Indian Creek looks like that by midsummer each year. And irrigation is the top water user in the West because of our big westward migration, because of the pattern of settlement, and because those were the earliest water rights that were put to use. And in fact, the Western states lead the nation in irrigation because of our arid lands and because we don't have as much precipitation as the rest of the country. And in fact, for that same reason, we also are the top groundwater users. So we have what I call this structural problem for both cities, towns, and ecosystems in the West. right? We have arid conditions west of the 100th meridian. We've got very dry conditions, and we've got a lot of agricultural use because that's how the West was settled, and that's a lot of our dominant history. And we have a system of water laws that rewards using your water to the fullest extent, first in time, first in right, and the second corollary, use it or lose it, right? So what does that mean? That means if you don't divert the water out of the stream and put it to use, then the next guy can say, hey, you've stopped using your water. It's mine now. That's a usufructuary right. So it's a right of use. You have to maintain that use in order to maintain that valuable right. And so it's a system that encourages, it's almost like a legal system that's designed to cause fighting and designed to cause conflict between users rather than a system that's designed to see about equitable sharing or allocating scarcity across multiple uses. And so one of the challenges of wrestling with water scarcity in the West is not only the geographical challenge of how dry we are and our cycle of increasing dryness, but it's a legally structural challenge of the legal system driving people to both overuse and completely use what is theirs, and a system that actually invites conflict. I get all of mine because I'm senior before you get a single drop, and I don't care what your cows are doing. That's the system. What does that mean for the West in the 21st century? How do we take this legacy that we have inherited here, both as Montana and as Westerners, and how do we change that to get to a different outcome, to get from conflict, from Remington's depiction of fighting for the waterhole, to a place where we are managing our water resources for multiple uses, where we can find that place of balance between vibrant agricultural economy and a vibrant agricultural use, between adequate water supplies for our cities, rural towns, and communities, and how do we support those healthy ecosystems that in the end are so crucial to providing those fresh water supplies for our agriculture and our cities, right? How do we find that state of grace, that art of moving from conflict to resolution? You are foreshadowing my next chapter. So the comment was, if we look around the world, there are places that have given water rights, the legal right for an ecosystem or a river or stream to have water in it. And you're right, the Australia, New Zealand have been very progressive, South Africa has also been very progressive, and the Great Lakes have been very forward-thinking about protecting their fresh water supplies. Another California example, the resolution of the conflict between commercial fisheries and commercial agriculture. And one of the most famous cases coming out of that California decades-old conflict is the Mono Lake case, which is one of the foundational cases for something called the public trust doctrine. And that public trust doctrine is kind of a counterweight or a legal counterbalance to the system of prior appropriation, because the public trust doctrine says, for those natural resources in which we all share and which play an important part in maintaining the functioning of our planet as we know it, there is an inherent right for those ecosystem processes to be protected. Sort of a public interest right in our ecosystems. And there's an obligation of our sovereign states at both the state and federal levels to look out for the shared public interest in those functioning natural resources. And that's where the California Supreme Court made some very important law on that public trust doctrine, protecting the commercial fishery of Mono Lake from the large straw that was extending all the way from Los Angeles to get Northern California's water. It's one of the great water fights of the 20th century.
You are tuned to KGVM Bozeman.
We've talked about overdrafting of aquifers, and we've talked about over-diversion of surface water supplies, but there's an incredibly important connection between those two sources of water, a unity of the hydrologic cycle, because groundwater and surface water at the end of the day are one connected water resource. What about one solution? One solution is to actually create the ability for streams and rivers to hold a water right. and to accept a transfer of a senior water right from another source. And typically that means from an agricultural source because they hold most of the senior water rights. Now, in order to do that, we had to change in Montana, we had to change our Western water law. And I will tell you a short story about that because in hindsight, and now where we sit in 2019, it kind of seems almost like a foregone conclusion. We're like, well, that makes a lot of sense. That's a great tool. Let's put that tool in the toolbox. What's the fuss? Well, 20 years ago, there was quite a bit of fuss about that. And in fact, the first time that the proposal was actually even contemplated and brought up at the Montana legislature, there was literally busloads of opposition from agricultural users coming to the Capitol. There was such opposition to even the discussion of that idea that they had to move the hearing from the state Capitol building to the gymnasium at Carroll College. That had almost never been done before. And no surprise that with that outpouring of opposition, that early bill in 1989 died a sudden and resounding death. So they're like, well, time to regroup. That idea went over like the literal lead balloon. So what happened then? And this is where, to me, after working for 20 years in Montana and then over the last decade, taking some of what Trout Unlimited and myself and others have done in Montana and looking at other parts of the West and working at the national scale, one of the reasons I think we can get some very forward-thinking things done in Montana is that we're a small town with very long streets. And we can actually talk to each other because there's not that many of us. And what happened in 1989 is the folks that proposed that bill, that's Trout Unlimited primarily, with the Montana Wildlife Federation and a few others, we just went around and started talking to people. Talked to agricultural leaders, talked to senior water right holders in basins, and said, tell me what you're afraid of. What is dangerous about this proposal, and we'll fix it. We'll make sure that doesn't happen. And the answers were, we don't want all of the water to go to California. We're like, fair concern. We don't either. So in the law, the next time it came around was that if there was a withdrawal more than 3,000 acre feet, you had to get legislative approval for that. So that was one concern. Another concern is they wanted to try it out and make sure that it was not going to put agriculture out of business. So they didn't want to institute something permanent. We're like, fine, let's do a trial period. Just a pilot, we'll test drive it, see how it works, and if you don't like it, it's gone. So we did a number of things that way. They wanted more notice. They wanted to make sure that if anything was going to happen, that it was given more lead time, more public notice, more discussion opportunity than other water right changes. We're like, fine, we'll be happy to talk anytime we're trying to do this. So we then slowly built a coalition of willing partners and reintroduced the bill two sessions later. It was difficult, there was heated debate, but we didn't have to shift the hearing from the state capitol to Carroll College's gymnasium. And the bill passed, and it was a limited bill, and it was a small tool. But what happened then was very interesting to me. Because then we had a 10-year window to try out this pilot, and Trout Unlimited began to work with producers and on a producer-by-producer basis said, where it works for your operation, where it works for you, and where it works for the fish, we will try this. And there is a long backlog of century-old irrigation infrastructure out there that is just waiting to be fixed. Because as we talked about, most of these water rights were perfected in the late 1800s. It's now over 100 years later. And so there's tremendous opportunity to bring those infrastructure upgrades and to reduce the amount of diversion needed and leave more water in stream. So me, every time I see a dilapidated head gate, I just see an opportunity for restoration. And what we did is began to work on those stories and begin to create a whole basket of examples where this was good for agriculture, it kept agriculture in business, it improved reliability of water delivery, and it restored fisheries. To me, seeing that we were making real durable change was when in 2005, that 10-year period was up and we had to renew that law. There was literally one vote in opposition to making the law permanent. One legislator voted against it. And we had testifying for us, not conservationists, but producers saying that this had been good for their operation. And to me, that was part of the shift. That's part of the story, that we don't have to live with legal constraints that are preventing good collaboration and preventing good restoration. If it's illegal, just change the law. Having a legal system working against you isn't the end of the world. It just means you have to be smarter than the laws, right? So that story of how that evolution of the acceptance of that particular tool, to me, is one that's very hopeful and that speaks to sort of the rationality and the community-mindedness of Montana, that we can actually just talk to each other, listen to concerns, and craft solutions that do work for everybody. And other Western states have followed suit. What that law did is it said this boogeyman of first in time, first in right, and use it or lose it is getting in the way of these kind of collaborative solutions. So we need to be able to protect your water right when it's used in the stream, when that water is used by the fish in the stream, and to keep maintain those stream and river flows. And here I've kind of divided up sort of four aspects of that legal ability and that legal change. And one is that using the water in stream is an actual valid use for a water right, right? That had to be done. Another one was that you could do a temporary change, right? You could do both. You make it permanent, like a, say, conservation easement, but it could also be temporary. You want to do it just for a couple of years or maybe a period of 10 years, right? Don't want to be tied to it forever. But in some cases, you may want a permanent dedication, right? Either for the amount of money or for the particular situation. So you want the option of having it more like a conservation easement, but having it for an in-stream use. And then this is what we did here in Montana, different than other states. We wanted the flexibility, and that was part of our listening to agricultural producers. We wanted the agricultural producer to be able to hold that in-stream right in their own name. So their portfolio of water rights didn't change. They still had the same volume, the same priority, the same date, but now it was almost just changing the color of it. Now, a portion of their water right they could hold as an in-stream use rather than an agricultural use. Or if they didn't want to have the bother of holding that, they could transfer that either to an NGO, a conservation group like Trout Unlimited, or the state could hold it, our Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. So we created in the law a whole multitude of options depending on what the producer's preference was for how that water right stayed protected. So that's Montana. We have all of those elements. Some of the other Western states are still working on or working on getting to that whole four pieces of the pie, and that's what the different colors mean. And then this is an important piece, this circle around the outside. I'm calling that transaction costs, meaning basically what's the paperwork hassle for making that legal change? And that's where some of our states in the Pacific Northwest have more flexibility from the agency point of view to do the transactions with lower paperwork costs, lower time, and less analysis of the water rights. But they also have a limitation, which is that they don't have the flexibility to have the agricultural producer hold that water right in their own name. You can see that this sort of legal structure is a little bit of a balancing act. It's like you can streamline the process, but then you lose some of the flexibility. You can have a full suite of flexibility, but then the process for doing the water right changes gets a little stickier. But the big change, I mean the sea change, is that over the last two decades, every single Western state now can hold some form of an in-stream water right. And that was not true 20 years ago. So next, I want to just do three quick examples of using that tool here in Montana. And this is where I could talk for a really long time, so I will try to move pretty quickly through these so I don't bore you to tears, because for me, these are great stories and some of the things that are most meaningful to me about using this tool. But I just want to run through them to show a couple of different approaches, show the results of that restoring that natural infrastructure, that ability of ecosystem services to provide freshwater sources when we do some restoration, and to show that there's not just one way to use these tools. One example is the Blackfoot River Basin, where Trout Unlimited has been active for more than a quarter of a century working on stream restoration and has really pioneered an approach that is a model across the United States for collaborative restoration among ranchers, anglers, and community members. And when they started this effort, essentially every single stream in the basin was impaired. And so they measured, asked the question, well, how is it impaired? And more importantly, came up with at least an approach for, and what should we do about it? And restoring the flows was one of the key factors to making all of the stream restoration work, right? You have to re-soak that sponge. One of the first ones was Rock Creek, and it was chosen, even though there was a very sophisticated prioritization based on importance of the fisheries population of imperiled species. We have listed under the Endangered Species Act, the bull trout. So they had identified key bull trout spawning streams that we needed restoration. This was chosen as the first because you cross over it on the highway going through the whole watershed on the way to the bar in Ovando, right? So this was the great case study because everybody who was going to Ovando to the bar was going to drive over the creek. And so it was a perfect first case study and what mattered way more than all of our fancy fisheries prioritization about imperiled species. And it had been both damaged in terms of its channel structure by grazing and also had lost its water. And so what we did is we worked with one producer to change their method of irrigation from flood irrigation to using a pivot and lining their lateral with a pipe. They actually delivered the same amount of water to their field, but they did it instead of diverting most of the flow into a ditch and running it across their land, it went into a pressurized pipe and got distributed by a pivot, right? The big circular pivot out there. So what was important was that it wasn't a very big amount of water, 1.5 cubic feet per second. That's a standard measure of water because it's a small stream. But it was for a long time, 25 years. That's the length of our Farm Bill agency, the Natural Resources Conservation Service. That's how long they say this pivot will last. So that's, you know, the water is tied to this new infrastructure. So we said, okay, we'll do it for 25 years and longer if the pivot lasts longer. And it cost $65,000. And the return on that investment was really high. And we can talk about that return on investment not only just because now we have a flowing creek, but also what about the ecosystem response to that? Before restoration, we had a couple of species. As the restoration progressed, both the habitat and the flow restoration, you had this big diversity of species coming in, and we have not only the imperiled species coming back, the endangered bull trout, but the candidate species and the native trout West Slope cut, but all of a sudden the trout were back too, the rainbows and browns. And so you had this great resilience and this blossoming of biodiversity in the creek when the water was returned. And the story of the Blackfoot is the repetition of this over and over and over across that quarter century after people drove by on the way to the bar in Ovando and saw Rock Creek and said, all right, Earth didn't spin off its axis, looks pretty good, maybe I can give this a try. Over 400 projects, 200 individual landowners, and millions of dollars invested in restoration. And what's the result? I love this graph because it tells two stories. The first story, this is three different creeks, and this is our imperiled bull trout, and it's the number of reds where the bull trout go in and lay their eggs in the stream, and then we have spawning, right? So this is just showing an increase in the bull trout. And the bull trout are particularly good kind of canaries in the mine because they require very cold temperatures and very clear water for the successful spawning. And so to get this increase in the number of reds observed means not only did you have some of those conditions present, right, so it's a good indicator of restoration, cold and clear water, but also that you had survival from 1 year to the next. So we have this nice increase in the number of reds over time. And then here, drought. We had drought. So to me, one of the best parts of this graph is what happens after 2000 in the midst of these punishing droughts. Well, yes, we got a decrease in the number of reds, but the success story to me, when people now use the term drought resilience, it's kind of become in our public lexicon. It's like this slide to me, is what drought resilience is about. Because here, these canaries in the mine, they were harmed by drought, right? They saw a population decrease, but the drought in 2000 was more severe than the drought in the 90s. So you had more severe drought conditions, but were able to maintain a higher population. To me, that's the indicator. That's drought resilience. You're creating a more resilient system. There's more water available. You're keeping those channels wet. The fish have a place to go. They can find these thermal refugia. That is what drought resiliency means. And that's where, like the California Prop 1 investment, a portion of that $7.5 billion investment was for that drought resilience, to make our natural systems be able to be better providers of our fresh water. Where do you get the money to do all this? And that's where our Trout Unlimited staff and our Watershed Group staff have become masters of piecing together pots of money. Because there are federal pots of money through the Farm Bill and through Reclamation, Department of Reclamation for projects. That money has to be matched by state and private sources. Often you can get project money, but you can't get the money to pay for the person to come up with the project in the first place. There's this kind of ongoing cycle of piecing together different funding sources to make this work. And in the end, a lot of the really key money comes from private charitable donations, because that's the money that pays for the people to have the conversations, to come up with the ideas, and to put the projects together. And for me, as I've grown this water program for Trout Unlimited, part of the reason that I shifted from doing just state-based work and now in the last 10 years have been doing more regional and federal work is because we were able to hire more people, and I had more people going out into different river basins and doing projects. And I was like, they need more money. And so part of what I felt like my job now was to take care of these nascent watershed-based efforts and bring more state and federal resources to those efforts, because that's how you get to scale. If I just did that work, I would have a wonderful project-by-project legacy, but it wouldn't be enough. I can't do enough across the entire Western United States in my lifetime to really make a difference. What I needed to do was to start turning the battleships of our federal resources and our federal agencies from the conflict-oriented way of doing things to the collaborative way of doing things, and investing in the natural infrastructure, investing in our rural communities, and investing in our Western producers in ways that created benefit not only for Western agriculture, but for our natural systems and for our communities. And that has been part of my own professional shift over time, is to try to bring these kinds of resources to bear to the problem. The question was, does a change in the creek restoration, have a change in the water table? I would love to do a whole nother Wonderlust talk on this topic, because it's a great topic. The answer is yes. But what we're also learning, because the science of stream and river restoration is a relatively new undertaking. It's only about 50 years old. I mean, our environmental laws only date back to the 1970s. Right? We're only beginning to get good at this. And we made a lot of mistakes along the way. But what we're understanding is that there are particular types of restoration that we can do that have the best or the biggest impact on the water table, on that whole hydrologic restoration. And one of my goals sort of moving forward is, how do we maximize that hydrologic restoration? How do you get the driver of hydrology to work for you and begin to help with the natural sponge and to drive the restoration of the whole system? I have a great staffer in Missoula who is just doing an amazing job of addressing abandoned mine reclamation, right? So the big piles of mining waste that are dumped often in the floodplain, because that's an easy place to dump it, and then are leaching toxic metals into rivers, like it's a bad thing. No one wants to deal with it because it's abandoned. So we have this fabulous engineer, Paul Parsons in Missoula, who has been just an ace at pulling together federal money to remove these big piles of mine waste out of the floodplain and then restore the creek at the same time. Often the creek is channelized and has to go back into its natural channel. Well, that got the attention of a very bright young master's student at University of Montana, who said, hey, let's measure what happens downstream, when you reconnect the stream to its floodplain, when you take out those abandoned mine tailings, because he was doing this at scale. He was doing miles of river valley, often in the national forest lands. And what she did great job of, you know, it was her master's thesis, so she had radon testing. I'm getting too detailed. She was great. She tested this. Like, what she found was that for every mile of valley bottom restored, there was a 1 acre foot increase of flows from the groundwater back into the stream. So you could literally measure from a mile-by-mile basis the increase in flows from reconnecting the stream to its floodplain. And I think that kind of targeted restoration holds great promise for actually increasing our water supplies. And the great thing about that restoration was it also delivered the water at the time it was most needed, because that additional flow came in the late summer. Right, because the spring flows charged the sponge of the floodplain in the spring, and then it came back out through groundwater downstream in the late summer. What we did with Sean and Maggie Murphy, fourth generation folks on the Occioke Ranch, is that Park Branch Canal had disconnected the North Fork of Fridley Creek from the Yellowstone River. It just was a casual conversation. I happened to be over there one day with a land trust because they just put a conservation easement on their property. And Sean just turned to me and goes, "Hey, do you think you could reconnect this stream?" And I'm like, "Excellent question. Let's make it happen." So we did that. And part of what we did was not only reconnect the stream by passing it underneath the canal. So we actually physically reconnected the stream. We took Sean Murphy's family off of surface water and put them on groundwater. So that's not reducing their water, but it's moving it from a constricted source, that North Fork of Fridley Creek, to abundant source, which right there was the groundwater and was not unsustainable, right? Because it was at a rate of pumping that was small enough it could be replenished. Why I wanted to talk about this project was not only because it's local, but because that's a way of using the tool of groundwater pumping in a very strategic way to restore flows. And for the native Yellowstone cutthroat trout that we're trying to restore within the Yellowstone River system, those trout found that restored stream within weeks of it being reconnected, both physically and with the flows. So it's another hopeful note of how fast these aquatic systems can recover. Another project we did was looking at storage water and asking the question, could we take some water that's already being stored and put it to other uses? In the 1990s, the Bitterroot River was severely dewatered as a main stem. We had an opportunity to purchase some of the shares in the storage reservoir in the upper part of the Bitterroot Basin that had come out of agricultural use and buy them permanently for in-stream use. And as a result, we restored, it may seem like a lot, 1.1 million, but that's for a permanent acquisition of over 100 CFS in the Bitterroot River. And that's the difference today between the river going dry and the river having fishable and floatable flows all season long. It's also an important bull trout refuge and critical habitat. The other issue we haven't really talked about is population growth, right? The West being the third coast, and how we're getting so much increase in the West. And so the question has to be, all right, we're already over-appropriated. What about all the people moving here? Where does their water come from? Well, and the answer, especially of California showing that, is, well, from the groundwater being one system with surface water, and the groundwater being so important to those surface flows that when you put a pump next to a river or stream, you may be taking the groundwater, but that groundwater was headed to the stream. So in reality, there was very little difference between actually pumping out of the stream or pumping the groundwater that got intercepted that would have been on its way to the stream. And what we did in Montana is the agricultural producers were getting upset when upstream new groundwater uses were taking their surface water rights. And we're like, the fisheries, right? We were also upset about that because that was using up what little slop in the system was left. And so we challenged the practice of unregulated groundwater pumping. And our Supreme Court agreed with us that our Water Resources Agency in Montana couldn't just hand out groundwater pumping permits without any analysis of how that was going to affect the senior water rights. And that was a landmark shift in Montana for integrating ground and surface water management. And what that has meant, it means that also the way that we solved that problem in Montana with after that Supreme Court decision was we came in with a change to our state laws to say what we did is we used what we had been learning about how to integrate ground and surface water and wrote into our state law that we kind of have a concept of bucket for bucket. It meant that for every bucket of new permitted groundwater use, you had to put a bucket of senior water right back into the stream. So you maintained the unity of the system. So you didn't have a downward spiral as more water rights were issued, that you at least kept a baseline. And that happened because, remember back in 1989 when I talked about all the busloads of opposition to the idea of having a transfer of water from an ag right to an in-stream right? Well, this legislation was passed because agricultural producers and anglers got together, wrote the legislation, and said, we need this. And it was the power of that coalition that just a couple decades before had been poles apart. It was that coalition that carried the day and passed what is now model groundwater legislation, not just for the West, but for the entire globe. And not only that, but we took this model of what we had done in Montana and we took it to Washington, D.C. and said, hey, you guys writing the farm bill, you need to pay attention to what we just did here in Montana, because we can't have something as big as farm bill funding increasing water scarcity and increasing conflicts over Western water. And we brought a wonderful family, the McGuires, who were one of the families that really had spearheaded and felt some of the most intense pressures from the upstream groundwater pumping in the Smith River Basin. He and I went together with his whole family back to DC, and he told his story over and over and over again to, as I drug him around to multiple congressional offices and agency offices, and his story really carried the day. And we changed not only the 2014 Farm Bill, but the 2018 Farm Bill also to help starting to incorporate these lessons learned in management in Montana. So we did that for permitted groundwater. What about unregulated groundwater? What we call exempt wells or wells too small for their own permit, right? So the issue is that many individual wells together are the same size as a permitted well. So again, senior water right holders and anglers went to the Supreme Court and said, this is wrong. You can't just have unregulated individual wells. You have to look at the impact of senior water rights on that unregulated use. And the Supreme Court again said, you're right. That makes no sense. You can't have that unregulated use. And so we have another Supreme Court opinion that has limited the amount of exempt well use and in these last 10 years have been working on expanding that mitigation effort that we pioneered for the single big use for the multiple small uses as well. And then the last thing I wanted to talk about is kind of a conclusion to how Montana has grappled with these changes and how it's kind of on the vanguard, is that in 2015, Montana passed a state water plan, and many of the other Western states were likewise in the process because they're all 20-year plans, and a lot of those states are kind of on the same 20-year cycle. Montana's water plan had several features of it that other states look to and actually have adopted, and there were four important pieces of that state water plan that were picked up from a lot of this restoration work and the pioneering collaborative work that had been done here in Montana. And that's to integrate the ground and surface water as one unitary resource, recognizing the science that drives that and having the law reflect the science. I know, crazy talk, right? But looking at watershed function to support a healthy water supply, recognizing that protecting flows in rivers and stream is important for both not only ecosystem function, but also for that freshwater natural supply. And finally, to begin to really incorporate changes from one use to another as one of the driving tools of 21st century water management. That transactions, that changes of use is one of our hallmarks of 21st century water management. And how well we continue to implement those tools will be based not only on the strength of our collaborative relationships, but also on how well we teach our sons and daughters and how well the next generation picks up on what we have started. How do we keep track of water? right? It's hard. It's difficult to measure. It's slippery, right? And it also changes by day and season. And so that's a very good question. And it's one that Montana is just beginning to grapple with. We do have the USGS system of stream flow gauges, which is so important. They're on every major river and stream in Montana, and they are maintained by our United States Geological Survey. And that's key for managing water at key points, but that's at a large river scale. At the tributary scale, we're doing a better job of having measurement devices on any diversion out of stream. That's on head gates and pumps. And then in addition, we're getting better, and in fact, our Montana legislature just this session passed a bill to increase the network of small tributary monitoring stations. And so that's an excellent question and one that we're only really beginning to answer, because before you can have enforcement of water rights, you have to first measure the water. So we're on the very front end of that.
You are tuned to KGVM Bozeman.
How do we share stories and share learning not only across states in the West, but internationally? Right? Because water security is a problem that affects our whole global community. And yes, the answer to that is that there is a real effort to have not only shared scientific understanding, but shared learning across different approaches. And there's whole institutes and nonprofit initiatives aimed at sharing that kind of learning. And in addition, because drought has become a more frequent and common occurrence here in the West, our federal government has elevated drought as a national scale issue. That has also helped increase the collaboration and the discussion across jurisdictions. We have a beaver question. So are beavers being used as a restoration vector? And the answer is yes, because beavers have a lot of energy and they work really cheap, right? And beavers, like my story about the floodplain reconnection and restoration with the abandoned mine tailing waste, beavers do that on a smaller scale. They reconnect a stream to its channel. So there's a whole emerging science around what we call aggradation structures. Those are structures in a stream that actually block sediment and create sediment deposition behind them, like a beaver dam. Right? And so part of what the beaver dam does is it slows the water down across the landscape. And especially as we face increasing temperatures and decreasing snowpack, or a snowpack that runs off earlier, anything that slows the water as it exits the landscape is going to help re-wet that sponge, right? It's going to create that, what I call that hydrologic driver, that hydrologic restoration. And we're only really on the front end of really understanding how important beavers were back before the turn of the century, and how we can both use them as a tool, but how we can also use what are called artificial beaver dams, so even bigger beaver dams on other stream systems, to create that aggradation structure, to create a structure that slows the water down, has the deposition, and raises the water table behind them. And it starts reestablishing what the landscape looked like at the time of statehood. There's no such thing as a stream too small for water rights. I was just out on a big ranch in eastern Montana, and there was looking at what's called an ephemeral stream system. So that's a stream system that only flows at certain times of the year, maybe even only flows certain years. And when I went back and actually did a water rights analysis of where I had been walking, and I thought, oh, maybe there's going to be one stock water right on this. There were pages of water rights on that small ephemeral stream system. So yes, there's no such thing as a water source too small for a water right. What about where a canal crosses a natural stream system, much like the example of the Ox Yoke Ranch in the Yellowstone? So that's the Park Branch Canal is a big irrigation ditch that kind of was built during the public works of the 1930s. And so in that case, what we did is we actually had a stepped system, and we just dropped the stream channel to flow underneath the canal, so that the canal, because formerly the creek just flowed right into the irrigation canal. There's no irrigation diversion below the canal, so it doesn't matter that the stream just goes into the canal. except for the fish, right? So what we did is we just stepped that creek down and brought it below the actual canal so to reconnect it. In other systems, in the Deschutes River Basin, for example, in eastern Oregon, they have done a fantastic job of modernizing whole irrigation districts and putting much of the main delivery canals into pipes, pressurized pipe, and in that way, natural stream systems then can pass easily underneath the pipes without having to do the whole stepping down of the channel. But even more importantly, those pressurized pipes don't take nearly as much water, and we're putting inline conduit in there. So there's hydro production through the canal that then pays for the cost of putting the pipe in the first place. Win-win.
Right.
For Colorado, so the law of the Colorado River is that that river basin is so, that seven-state river basin is so over-appropriated, and there's so much money at stake with the Colorado River Basin that even what we call rain barrels, like catching the water off your rain, that is illegal because that water is already guaranteed to somebody else. That's where we at the Headwaters in the Northern Rockies have a little bit more slop in the system. We haven't had to be very good about measurement and enforcement. We haven't had to be as precise about our water measurement and our enforcement of water rights because we have a little bit more water and we have fewer people. And so in some ways, not only our community, but our geography has made Montana a really perfect place to test drive some of these solutions so we can get a track record before we take them to places where the stakes are higher, there's more money involved, and there's more people drawing on the same source. Our area, Montana, can do for the nation. Can we solve a mid-sized, fast-growing city's water needs in a way that reflects both our agricultural heritage and our natural heritage and still serves a prosperous, growing community? So I have an idea that I have been trying to sort of test drive and get into the city sub Bozeman's municipal water supply planning. It's getting some traction, and it has, as usual, it's kind of a whole portfolio approach. One of the strands of the portfolio, as was mentioned, was very intense focus on water conservation. You get rebates for low flush toilets and low, you know, shower heads and sprinklers for your lawn that turn off when it rains, and right, so excellent focus on water conservation. But I think that's an important piece, but it's not sufficient. What also has to happen, I think, is that we have to create a system where our water supply is tied to our land use and our land use as we want to see it, right? We exert some forethought and say, this is the kind of place we want to live. At least for me, that answer is in part, I want to see agricultural lands on the beautiful soils in Gallatin Valley continue to be in ag land and ag production and continue to have a vibrant agricultural community in Gallatin Valley. So if I can tie water supply to that kind of land use, now we're building in a self-referencing system. So I have a plan that's called Green to Blue that I'm on the forefront of trying to get adopted in the city. So we'll see. I haven't totally worked it out yet, but it's a good idea. So it goes something like this. So why not use the annual crops produced in the valley as a source of drought supply for the city so that in drought years, you'll have producers who want to stay in production convert their water from an agricultural supply to municipal supply. And they get a payment for that that compensates them for their lost agricultural production. And they get also sort of a retainer, basically an annual payment for the hassle of it all, right? Because it's going to be a hassle, right? It's going to be a lot of paperwork and meetings and talking. So they'll do a retainer agreement, basically, and then what we'd call an option agreement or a drought year payment as well. And then what that allows us to do is because we already have the infrastructure in the city of Bozeman with Highlight Reservoir, you don't need physical infrastructure to switch from that ag use to the municipal use. You're basically just switching the accounting of the shares in the Highlight Reservoir from irrigation purpose to municipal purpose, right? Going from alfalfa to city lawns in only those drought years. And that keeps then agricultural lands in production around the city because now they are actually part of the city's water supply. And the extra payment for their water rights in drought years helps offset some of the steep costs of keeping that land in ag production. does the system of individual wells and individual septic systems impact both water quantity, but also water quality? And the answer to that is yes. And there's been a tremendous amount of work done, particularly along the Gallatin River corridor in the Big Sky area, because they've had so many issues with failing water septic systems along that Gallatin River corridor. And then that, because it's upstream, that affects us all going downstream. And in addition, our Gallatin Local Water Quality District has done a tremendous job of tracking pollutants coming from septic systems into our groundwater. Right? So then that is basically having pollutants migrate from septic systems to other people's drinking supply, their groundwater wells, that aren't treated, because many of those pollutants are either pharmaceuticals or products found in sunscreen. So that's a tremendous issue that we're only beginning to really understand the extent of the problem. That 2016 Supreme Court case I mentioned is one important step towards that problem, because that is regulating the density of permit-exempt wells, of individual wells. And from a cost basis, from a development basis, it's trying to level the playing field of the cost of hooking up to a municipal system versus just punching in an individual well. And when those costs start to be more on par, then there's less incentive just to go out and divide up agricultural land.
You have been listening to a Wanderlust talk entitled Water Rights, Water Fights, Water Supremacy in the West, given by Trout Unlimited's Laura Ziemer. It was recorded at the Belgrade Public Library on the evening of April 4th, 2019. This has been a Beyond the Deep End production, recorded and produced by Joy LeClaire for KGVM Bozeman, Gallatin Valley Community Radio. You can find more lectures of local interest and concern at www.kgvm.org, where you can also contribute your financial support for this all-volunteer community radio station. And we thank you for your support.